It is my pleasure to welcome, for the first time, to Many Rivers Books and Tea, Reverend Terry Daniel. She is, as you see, the author of these three books and I think more, if I'm not mistaken. So these are the three in this genre. This particular one, of course, as you see, Embracing Death, A New Look at Grief, Gratitude, and God. Certainly not irrelevant to conscious dying and conscious grieving, which is our topic for tonight. Reverend Terry Daniel has obviously been working with these issues for a while to have produced these three books. I know she does lots of public events and workshops, that sort of thing. Please join me in welcoming Reverend Terry Daniel to Many Rivers Books and Tea.
Hi, everybody. I'm so happy that you're here, and I recognize some of you from Jerry Grace Lyons' thing a couple weeks ago and from other places. I'm new here. I've just lived here 4 months, hence this being my first time speaking here, though I lived here 40 years ago.
Wow.
And now I'm back. And downtown Sebastopol has really changed. There's a nightlife here. There's actually people out at night. It used to be that way. We don't have a lot of time, and I have so much stuff that I want to talk about, so I'm going to probably jump around all over the place. I'm going to, I think, just start with a really quick little background on who I am and how I came to this work. The really short story. I was always a spiritual mystic kid my whole life. I found out only about 10 years ago that my grandmother and great-grandmother were psychic. I didn't know that, but they used to see dead people all the time. My mother didn't tell me that until I started talking to dead people. I was raised in a completely non-religious Jewish family who their entire idea of God and theology was Hanukkah has eight nights and we just get eight presents. That was my religious upbringing. In high school, public high school in Los Angeles, for some reason, I don't know how this was allowed to happen, but there was a class called The Bible as Literature. And I took this class and we studied the Pentateuch, the first five books of the Bible, reading it as a piece of literature that somebody wrote. I was blown away by that and went from there to read the entire Bible when I was 16. When I was 19, I read the Tibetan Book of the Dead and so on and so on and so on. And became enmeshed in spiritual seeking. Fast forward to age 46-ish, I had a 10-year-old son who was diagnosed with incurable illness, and so went through those years of caregiving and preparing myself for his departure. One of the things that was really important in that process was I realized that 10-year-old kids in America, the only thing they know about death is what they see on TV and movies and video games, and that's just violent and people screaming and blood. And I didn't want him to think of his death that way. So I started to do research on other ideas about death. And I would go to the library and I'd find books, for children on Buddhist cosmology and Native American stories and anything I could to read to him, and began teaching him about what death was like. And of course I know now that actually he was teaching me. I was sitting there pretending to be the mother and the person who knew stuff. I didn't know anything. He knew everything. And so then he died when he was 16. He had a very beautiful, pristine death. And 30 minutes after that, he showed up and started talking to me and basically said, "Okay, let's get this party started. We've got work to do. This was our plan. Here we are. I'm going to be over here on the other side. You're going to be over here on Earth, and we got stuff to do. So start taking notes." And that's how the first book, A Swan in Heaven, came. And then the second book sort of followed that, and so on. And I was so overwhelmed with this interest in death and this closeness that I felt to the other side. I didn't know what to do with it. And I thought, maybe I should go be a nurse and then I can be around death. And that didn't feel right. And ultimately it led to hospice, and I was a hospice volunteer for years. One thing led to another, and I ended up in theology school getting all these degrees in theology so that I can teach about death, dying, and bereavement to younger people, to undergrads, so that we can have a nice generation of people in their 20s raising their own children to not be afraid of death. So that's my backstory. There's a lot more to it, but you'll find out. One of the things that I started doing in this process of creating and writing books and teaching and all this was I created this little thing called the Afterlife Conference. Have any of you ever heard of it?
The Afterlife Conference.
And the Death Awareness Institute. So this is a big conference we have every year in a different city. And all the leaders in the field of afterlife research are involved. Raymond Moody, you probably know who he is, who wrote Life After Life. He's on our board. He's a good friend. Eben Alexander, the neurosurgeon who was in the coma. You guys probably have heard of these people. So that's what our conference is about. And if you're interested in coming this year, it's in Portland. And so here's flyers, and this is the last shameless commerce pitch I'll give you tonight. There's the flyers, $25 off coupons. Okay, we're done with that. So, we're here to talk about grief and bereavement, and somebody said something earlier about they didn't want to come in here to talk on grief, and I realize it's because people always associate grief with the loss of someone who dies. So let's start by just recognizing that grief happens all the time. We're losing things all the time. You lose your job, you grieve. You lose your leg, you grieve. You lose your house. So grief is something that we walk with and live with all the time, just like death is. Death is the loss of your identity as a physical body. In grief, we lose our identities as well. So one of the things that happens with loss and trauma, the biggest thing that happens, is the shattering of assumptions. And has anyone ever read a book called Shattered Assumptions by Ronnie Janoff Bowman? Wonderful book. And here's what she lays out. We live in this world with basic assumptions of safety. And the assumptions are something like, you know, I'm going to leave here and get in my car and drive home, and I assume I'm going to make it. We fall in love, and we get married, and we have babies, and we get a dog, and we buy a house, because we assume that those things are going to remain intact. If we didn't have those assumptions, we would never take any risks. We would never get in the car. We would never buy a house or have a relationship or have a child. But what happens, by the time you've lived a little bit of life, maybe by the time you're 25 or so, you realize that maybe marriages don't last forever. Maybe children do die before their parents. Maybe that big job that you just got isn't going to last, which means that the house that you just bought might not be able to be paid for. But we have to have these assumptions in order to live. So what happens to us when we face traumatic loss is that we haven't just lost the thing, the loved one, the house, the job, we've lost our sense of safety in the world. And that's something that we've all been through, even though we may not have had someone close to us die. And by the way, you can ask questions and talk throughout instead of waiting to the end.
Lost our innocence.
We lose our innocence. But usually we're not aware of that happening when we're children. But somebody said earlier, we're age. We lose, God, my knees are gone. You know, we lose our sex drive. We lose our collagen in our skin. I mean, it's just a constant process of loss. Mm-hmm. So we need to have tools for coping with loss and coping with change and transition. So what I'm going to talk about tonight and what I teach is a new way of looking at loss. And what I often say to people is, if you think that the losses in your life were someone else's fault caused by that guy over there, or that they were random and meaningless, or that they were punishment from some god in the sky, then you're going to hear something very different here from me tonight. And that's part of the reason why I immersed myself in theology, because I wanted to learn about that god in the sky and why people thought of it the way they did. And that is important because in my grief counseling practice, I hear the most heart-wrenching stories that you can ever imagine. And I hear these every day, where people come to me and say, Well, I came home from work and opened the garage door to park my car and found my 16-year-old son hanging there. Murders, suicides, just the worst stuff. And a lot of these people come to me and they bring their theological conundrum with them. And it sounds something like this. I thought if I was a good person and pleased God, that something like this would never happen to me. One client that I had, her son died at age 9 from cancer, and she really believed that because she had had an abortion back in college when she was young, that God was punishing her for that and took her 9-year-old son. And a lot of people don't even realize that they have these deeply held, old, bad theology beliefs inside them until they're faced with something like this. The woman with the 9-year-old son said, I believe in reincarnation. I'm a new age person, but I think God's punishing me for having an abortion. So it's still in there. It's still, even in us in this room, it comes up. And one of the processes that I do in my workshop that I wish we had time to do tonight, but we don't, is, I'll describe it, is a version of the telephone game that you played when you were kids. So what I would do if we had time, and we don't, is I would take the oldest person in the room and the youngest person in the room and send you outside. And I would tell a story, a Native American creation myth, to us as if we are a tribe of people in the ancient world. Here's how our people got the sun and the moon and the stars and the water. Then we bring in the older person, and you, the tribe, imagine that he's a merchant from another village, and you are going to tell him the story that I just told you. Then we bring in the young person, and you, as the older person, the merchant, is now going to tell this young person, who's somebody else that you meet in your travels, you're going to tell her the story. You see what I'm saying? And the story, you can't believe how much it changes. Everything changes. In the story that I tell, it takes place in the Pacific Northwest. I've had people do it where they say, and that's how we got the Atlantic Ocean. And the names are changed, the stories are changed, the characters, the animals, everything has changed. And that happens in a 20-minute process. So imagine what happens over thousands of years with the stories of our theologies. And so I start out with this because it's so important to have a complete theological overhaul if you're going to cope with grief and loss. And I think that many of you here probably, maybe I'm assuming, may agree with the way I see it, which is everything happens for a reason, and it's all about having a balanced experience as an incarnate human. But that's hard for a lot of people to see. So I describe it often like everything in creation is like pieces in a kaleidoscope. And they seem to be separate, but they all bump into each other and are all interconnected inside one container. So when something happens, like a tsunami or a tragedy, the kaleidoscope turns, all the pieces fall apart, and then they come together again. The point being that you're not just one piece. And your pain and your trauma and your loss and your drama is connected to every other thing. So when your loved one gets in a car accident with a drunk driver, every piece of the kaleidoscope that is pulled into that event, the paramedics, the driver, his family, you, your family, the doctors, the nurses in the hospital, your loved one, every person you ever talk to from that day forward is going to be impacted by the way you've been changed by this event. It just keeps fluttering out. Nothing is disconnected. You guys probably know this. This is very hard for people in the general public to understand because we get so attached to our own little drama and our own little story. But that's my husband. My husband died. My pain is terrible. And people get stuck there. And I've come up with a phrase for that kind of being stuck. I call it insulated versus ventilated. And I'll get to that in a minute. In fact, if you want to, that would be something really great to write down. If you wanted to write something down, insulate versus ventilate. You can email and I can give it to you later. So we'll come back to that. Another thing that I always like people to remember is a wonderful quote from one of my favorite teachers, Richard Rohr, and it's this: pain that is not transformed is transmitted. So think about the kaleidoscope again. So here you are, one little piece on the kaleidoscope. Your 9-year-old kid gets cancer. You think God is punishing you for having an abortion 30 years ago. And you're walking through your life with this horrible guilt and all this religious conflict. And it's transmitted to all the people around you, to your life, to your work. Another good example of that is something Carolyn Mace said. Some of you may have read this in her work. About, imagine that you come to Earth with 100 units of energy. Units, you know, ounces, inches, whatever. And you can use those units any way that you want. And you can use them to be hateful and bigoted and angry, or you can use them to be loving and open. And if you use them for fear, for doubt, for separation, for guilt, for blame, you're going to burn through those 100 units really fast. You're not going to have good energy left. So what happens if you're that person and you burn through all that? Where you still have to live. Where are you going to get more units from? From the people around you. Right? So then you start kicking your dog, fighting with your spouse, being just this dark person just sucking energy from everybody and everything around you. Then after you've used that up, you start pulling it from your own body. So that's what being insulated in your pain is. It's like having this insulation wrapper around you because you're so identified with your pain and your story and your drama that it's a closed system. And insulation, I'm using this because I'm insulating my house right now, that's what I'm thinking of. It's insulation with like this reflective coating on the outside, so it's pushing the energy away from you and holding the bad energy inside you. By contrast, and what we want to do through conscious grieving is to become ventilated, to do exactly the opposite of what you'd want the insulation in your house to do. You want to poke holes in that stuff so that what's around you is more like screen or mesh, so that there's ventilation moving through you. Instead of this closed up thing, it's this open thing. I spend a lot of time around traditionally religious people because I'm a seminary student right now, and sometimes we are called upon to pray. And the body language of prayer, of traditional prayer, just bothers me so much. This. This is not ventilated. And I watch that. I watch the Presbyterians at this seminary. They're going to pray. They go right to this. This is what I do. Or this. I hold my heart in my hand. This is how I pray. I look up. My eyes are open. I'm looking around the room. Everybody's like this. So this is the kind of tradition that we all came up with, and it's in us, even if we kind of intellectually and spiritually, we've all had spiritually transformative experiences, so we know that it's not true, but it's in there. So how do we ventilate ourselves? What are some techniques that you can think of that you guys probably do all the time to increase the ventilation?
Someone?
Talking. Perfect. Yes.
And meditation.
And time in nature.
Running.
Exercise.
Dancing.
Running, exercise, dancing is all about breathing. Right? Breathing is everything. And in what happens in nature, your lungs get clean air. So everything that we know in the kinds of spiritual practices that we do is with the breath, we open up and we become ventilated. And meditation is obviously one of those things, too. I'll tell you a really interesting thing about breath. So back to my son, who talked to me quite a bit from the other side for a very long time, especially while we were writing this book together. Anybody here work in hospice? Okay, and so you've seen people die? So when people are dying, a couple interesting things happens. One thing that often happens is their eyes, if they're in a bed, they're looking up, but their eyes are actually looking there. Has anybody ever seen that before? Another thing that happens that's more common is their breath goes through all these weird contortions. Mm-hmm. They can breathe really fast or really slow. They might breathe 3 respirations a minute, or they might breathe 30. And so I asked my son, because he did all those things, and I asked him, tell me what was happening with your breath. What's that about? And here's what he said. He said, you once asked me about why people have fewer respirations as they die. And this is a good time to explain that. As my body was dying and my breaths were fading and infrequent, there was a mirror image of each breath in heaven. And we use the word heaven, that's a whole other story, I'll tell you that in a minute. A mirror image of each breath in heaven, breathing in new life, in much the same way a baby takes its first breath outside the womb. With each weakening, struggling breath on earth, a mirror image breath occurs on the other side, getting stronger as each earth breath gets weaker, until the final breath closes one door and opens the other. What is breath on earth is light in heaven. Mm. And he calls that the breath mirror. So that's the ultimate ventilation, isn't it? It's just like leaving the body altogether. So I want to give you, we have such a short amount of time, I want to give you a quick meditation and a quick ritual that you can do when you need to ventilate. And this is especially true with grief. There's something now called grief yoga. Have you heard of this? And it's becoming very popular, and ideally the people teaching it are yoga teachers and also trained as grief counselors. And it makes a lot of sense, where you're opening the chest and letting the breath flow. Because in grief, it tends to get stuck in the heart, and we tend to close up like this.
Would this be similar to people who are using yoga to deal with PTSD?
Exactly. Absolutely. I mean, you know, yoga has known this about itself for thousands of years, is that's what it's for. And meditation is the same. So what I was hoping to do tonight was teach you some rituals, but we don't really have enough time. But I want to give you this really quick meditation. I call it the forgiveness flyby. And you can do this anytime, anywhere, and it ventilates you. So imagine, in fact, we'll just do it. So take a couple breaths, it's very short, and imagine some person or some event in your life that causes you pain or has caused you pain, something that your heart is tied up in a knot around. It could be a person or an experience. And if it's a person, just see them sitting there wherever you think they might be right now. And if it's an experience, paint the picture, create a scene of this experience. And try to keep your breathing really slow and really even while you go there. And now let your soul fly out of your body and literally fly over that scene. Fly over that person. And you're going to say to them, telepathically with your soul, if it's a person, I release you completely to your path. And if it's an event or an experience, I completely release my attachment to the pain of this experience. It's painful to do. We don't want to release that person. We want to think we have control of their path. or something to say about it. I release you completely to your path. I release completely my attachment to this wound. Remember to breathe deeply. And that's it. That's the forgiveness flyby. You can do this 20 times a day. You can do it while you're driving your car. You can do it every time you get angry, every time you get locked into the pain. When I left my third husband, I had lots and lots of anger. And I did this meditation constantly. And it worked. But I couldn't bear the thought of releasing him to his path. No, I don't like your path. I want your path to be what I want you to be. That's always the number one, the only conflict in any relationship. You won't do what I want you to do. There is nothing else. So this helps you unhook from that. And if it's a death or a trauma or a loss, what you're unhooking from is your identification with the event. Now, one of the things we do in the full day grief workshop that I teach is we focus on internal transformation versus external events. Does that make sense? So the external event is my teenage kid hung himself in the garage. That's never going to change. That's never going to leave you. You can't do anything about that. You can only do the internal transformation. So little meditations like the forgiveness flyby are helpful. Another little ritual, and there's so many rituals that you can do with something like this, is create a little space in your house to be a sacred space, a little altar of some kind. Put objects on that altar that represent your attachment to that experience. It could represent your pain, it could represent your love. In the grief workshop, we have these beautiful altars with pictures of our loved ones, and people bring their sacred objects, like if their dog died, they bring the dog collar and little pieces of dog food. It's just so beautiful. And have this little altar, and it's the same meditation, only now you have physical representations. And you go and you light a little candle, and you breathe, and you say, I release my pain and anger into the light. I release my pain and anger into the light. Or whatever it is. My rage, my blame, my jealousy. And again, it's hard to do this, to stand there and say, okay, here's this picture of the worst shit that's ever happened to me, and I am now going to stand here and state to the universe that I'm letting it go. We don't want to let it go. Because it defines us. And it should define us, but the healing of it is what we want to define us, not the stuckness in it. So I'll give you some examples of, there's a grief group for bereaved parents, a national group. It's very big. Actually, they're all over the world. And they have a conference every year, and I went there once. And there are people who come there year after year after year, 25 years after the death. And some of those deaths are, you know, stillborn babies or miscarriages. And this group provides wonderful things. It provides community. One of the things that grieving people really need to do is know that they're being heard. It's very important to tell your story. Somebody said talking is a way of ventilating. You absolutely have to talk about your story. You absolutely have to be with other people who can relate to what you've been through. However, you have to also move to the next level of healing. And to go every year to the same group of people and tell the same stories over and over and over again without any tools for transformation does not help you heal at all. And there have been studies done on this group that show that it's actually damaging to people because they're focused on the external event. It's strange to be there. They make a little badge with a picture of their kid, and everyone has this little badge, and people walk up to each other and go, oh, hi, is that your daughter? How did she die? And that's the conversation for the whole weekend. It's being stuck in the story. And the story is about the external event. Okay. You guys can interrupt me if you want. So I want to also tell you something about grief work. So you've heard the term grief work? A lot of people don't know that that was actually coined by Freud. Sigmund Freud wrote a paper called Mourning and Melancholia in 1933, thereabouts, and he laid out this theory of how to deal with grief, and this was his theory, that the person has to really get into the teeth of it and feel the pain, look at the old pictures and reminisce and cry and feel, and that's all good, and do all that, with the ultimate goal of detaching from the lost loved one, of peeling off from that relationship and letting it go. And one of the things we know in grief theory now is you never tell a grieving person to let go or move on. The idea is not to let go, it's to repackage the relationship. Well, Freud's idea was, if your loved one died, you're going to be a mess until you completely detach from that relationship, put it away somewhere, and cut it off. That theory became the foundation for all of grief psychology until about the mid-1960s. Maybe a little bit later than that. Probably 70s. And so, kind of in our baby boom generation, the researchers who were coming up in our generation were starting to say, no, that doesn't make sense. And what about the spiritual piece? Okay, here's another thing that happened around that same time, 60s, 70s. 1950, China invaded Tibet, kicked all the monks out of all the monasteries, burned them down, burned the books. The monks left and fled into exile. They went to India. They spread around. Eventually, they came to Europe, and eventually, they came here. They brought Buddhism with them. That is how we got Buddhism. That's why it was really popular in the 50s with the beatniks. That's how it came to us. This tragedy for Tibet became a gift to the West. So that started to open up our thinking about why things happen the way they do, and that the universe has many levels to it, not just the Judeo-Christian version. So that happened. And at the same time, people were waking up. We were having revolutions about everything. You know, we bashed religious traditionalism, we bashed sexism, we bashed homophobia, we stopped a war in Vietnam. All of this was happening. And this is when these researchers started to do their work with grief and coming up with new theories. And the new theories were, you do not detach from the relationship, you reinvent it. You do not end the bond, you have continuing bonds. And the idea of continuing bonds came from having a multicultural perspective where they looked at how other cultures dealt with grief. So in China, when somebody dies, you make a little altar to them, you keep it in your house for a year or for however, you put food on it, they actually put money, they have this continuing relationship with the person. And of course, in many, many cultures, we honor the ability of the departed to come back and forth between the worlds and continue to communicate with us. So that's all coming new, and that's what's turned Freud's theory on its head, and that's why it's all changing now. Yeah.
I'm wondering if the thing that I do is similar to what you do in the releasing. I say this point in the journey. This point in the journey. This point. That point in the journey. This point. Is that
pretty cool. You know what that is, I think, to me? That's creating movement.
It's movement. It's movement. It's not movement. Absolutely right.
Yeah. And that's what's missing in traditional grief theory. So if you go to a grief counselor, and one thing I will say is, grief, death, loss, this is a normal human experience. It's not an illness, it's not a sickness. If your husband dies and you're grieving, there's nothing wrong with you.
So it has to do with attention. And if we're putting our attention on something that's imprisoning it, or if we're putting our attention on something that's liberating it.
Exactly. Yeah.
Liberation of attention. Yes. Mm-hmm.
And liberation is often comes from the movement, doesn't it? We're talking politics, you know? So movement is everything.
Yeah.
And so in these traditional things where you're just telling the same story over and over again, there's no movement. So I'll give you an example. In the full-day grief workshop, what we do is we have three altars, and throughout the day, we literally move stuff from one altar to the other. So the first altar, we put a picture of our pain. We actually draw a picture of our grief landscape. Have everybody draw a picture. And these pictures are so sad. I mean, you'll see like a little stick figure shooting itself with a gun, just our tears, and they're just heartbreaking. And we put these on the altar along with the dog's collar and the wedding rings and the sacred objects that people bring, and it's this beautiful altar. And I have everybody walk around it a couple of times, touching each object and really connecting in with the pain and the love. That's the first part. Second part is we have another altar with rose petals. This is a shamanic practice called a kintu, where you take the rose petals and you blow into them all the stuff that you want to cleanse and release. You put it in a little bowl, and you have a pitcher of water, and you pour the water into the bowl. Movement. See what we've done? We've physically moved from this place to this place. Later, the finishing part is we do a processional, and there's a lot of other stuff in between, where we take the pitcher of water, we take the bowl of the rose petals, and we do a processional out the door and into the woods or the river or wherever we are, and we pour the thing into the river and let the river take it away. So what we've actually done is physically act out the process of moving energy. This is what is completely missing in traditional grief counseling and grief group practices. Questions, thoughts, anybody?
Would you say that California is a little more ahead of in terms of incorporating movement into grief work, or are you finding that we're as traditional as, you know, maybe?
No, there's the coasts are always more progressive. I mean, I did a speaking tour in Colorado and Utah this summer at hospices, and I was shocked at what I saw there. The chaplains, a whole other conversation, but a chaplain in a hospice or a hospital is not the same as a minister or a pastor. It's very specific, different kind of training. And the chaplains at these hospices were just pastors from the local churches. And they had never had chaplaincy training. So they never learned the ethics and the things that we're supposed to know. And they would actually sit with dying patients and try to save them for Jesus before they died. Which in any hospice I've ever worked in, they would be fired immediately. But in that hospice, they were fine with that. So I was so shocked when I saw that. And we do a little process where we have people act out these scenarios. So we would pretend like, okay, you're the dying person. You're an atheist. This is your son. He's a born-again Christian. You're the chaplain. And we do a little role play. So, son, you're saying, well, please, please be baptized. I can't stand it if you're going to go to hell, Lana, please. And you're like, son, I'm dying right now. Could you just like back off of this, you know? And so you're in there intervening. It's absolutely fascinating. So in answer to your question, in the professional realm, yes, there are a lot of, and especially like these grief groups, there's a lot of people who haven't quite moved to that place. And so the new wave of teaching that's coming is you have to use ritual, you have to use symbolic objects, and you have to work with breath, and you have to work with movement. Without it, you are not going to heal. So back to that national organization for bereaved parents, they have a candle lighting thing, and they march through the streets with candle, which is very nice, and they have a little picture of their kid with the candle. And so I watch a march like that, and to me it's like, ah, movement. They're doing movement. But they don't know that's what they're doing. And they don't present it that way. And so the people doing it aren't quite getting the full benefit of understanding that symbolically they're doing that.
Yeah. I like how you're encouraging people to let go of trying to let go.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah, let go. Goodness, I can't...
So it's very shaming to let go.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes. Mm-hmm. Move on.
Yeah. It's a feel like there's something wrong with them if they can't do that. Okay. It's very shaming.
But at the same time, we know that there's some sort of letting go that we're supposed to do. But we don't really know what that looks like.
It seems like letting go happens as you let things be.
It's allowing transformation to happen, to let the relationship change. And one other thing about relationships, anybody who's ever been in a relationship, you've been married for 30 years, that relationship is not the same today as it was 30 years ago. It changes and evolves. So just because somebody dies doesn't mean that the relationship isn't just continuing to change as it always has. The big difference now is that they're on that plane and you're on this one.
What happened when your son stopped talking to you? Assuming that he did.
He has not.
Okay, because you referred to the fact that maybe he did.
Well, he talks to me differently now. So it used to be he could dictate an entire book. I mean, he would wake me up at night and say, get up, go to your computer. Or he wouldn't even say that. I could just feel it coming. It's just like the thoughts and the words would come and they're not mine. I mean, some of the things that he says, you know, he was trying to explain to me once, like, how interdimensional communication happens. And he says, well, it's like calling someone on a cell phone, except it's a soul phone. I never heard that anywhere. But somebody did actually steal that from me. My friend Gary Schwartz is actually using that now. I slapped his hand about it. So now what happens is he's like the man behind the curtain in The Wizard of Oz. I feel him all the time. He's always there. And what I see now is we're partnership. We're in co-creation. So when he first died, I lived in Alabama the last 2 years of his life. That's a whole other story. You can read it in that book. From there, I left my husband, moved 3,000 miles away to a little cabin in the Oregon mountains. And no one could have convinced me in a million years that I would go to a Catholic college and get a degree in religious studies. All of this, and then from there to here, to everything, starting the conference, everything I've done, I would have never imagined this for my life. And so he is now sending me to school. And it's kind of stuff that we're doing together. And everything I say, anytime I talk, right now when I'm talking to you, this is him talking through me. We've merged together. There's less separation. He's also busy doing whatever he's doing. I'm not trying to keep him here as my, you know, as my voice. What I've learned from this is that we are on many dimensions simultaneously. So he can be wherever he is and still be working with me and for me. So yes, he does still talk to me, but it's not like it used to be. I used to sit down at my computer and write 50 pages of just channeling. I don't need to do that anymore. I've absorbed those teachings and turned it into something that I can express. You just, kind of like a elementary school teacher, when they give you a math problem, they don't sit there yelling in your ear the whole time. They give you the problem and they go walk away and then they come back and check on it.
I just wondered about the impact of, you know, there's this whole phenomenon of near-death experiences, and there's been a lot of books written about it, and on, you know, the internet you can listen to people's stories, and a lot of people have mystical experiences that convinces them of an afterlife, and then they convince, you know, other people that haven't had a near-death experience that there's something to it, and some of them have verifiable instances. So that has really changed my view. And when I had a relative, a loved one, and a, you know, a nephew die, it was different for me than other members of my family. Mm-hmm. And it has been a bit hard sometimes to refrain from my point of view while they go through their grief.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel like I have, you know, I can contact them when I want, and I do, it's not like, you know, clear language, but there's just a connection. And so I don't know. It's really like sometimes I really want to help his mom, but it's
you can't.
Yeah.
Just forget that. Let that go. Seriously, I mean, one of the things that you learn in chaplaincy training is that you cannot bring your view to another person. Mm-hmm. Are you a chaplain?
No.
You keep not, no, you keep nodding like you really know what I'm talking about.
I work with kids, and I have a kid who just lost his stepdad a few years ago, and his mom just died about a year ago in April. Wow. So yeah, a lot of thoughts.
But yeah, it's really the hardest, because we know what we know, you know, we know about these mystical experiences and other levels of consciousness, and we know that consciousness continues after the body dies, but you can't tell that to a civilian, you know, I mean, they have to find it themselves, the same way that you did. Something quickly I want to say about near-death experience and afterlife research. Someone sent me a book last year wanting me to endorse it, and I read it and I loved this book so much that I invited this guy to come be a speaker at my conference, and it's called A Traveler's Guide to the Afterlife. Jim, you should have it in the store. And what he did, he's a researcher, he researched afterlife beliefs in little known cultures and minor religions. Okay, so we know the Judeo-Christian thing, we know the Hindu thing, we know the Buddhist thing, we're pretty familiar with these. He talked to, like, you know, small little Chinese sects out in the mountains and Zulu people in Africa, stuff we don't know about, and it changed my thinking. For example, the Zulu tribe, they believe in reincarnation and that a human can come back as an animal, but only a chief can come back as a lion. And then there's some shamanic tribes that believe, you know, if you kill an animal and you come back to the place that you killed it after you've eaten it and do something there, it guarantees that the animal will incarnate in a higher state. I mean, there's all this stuff. And so here I am in this afterlife community where we think we know about the tunnel and the light and the loved ones and the life review and all this stuff, and I realize we're just as dogmatic as everybody else with that. Because if you look at the NDE research, everybody's experience is a little bit different. And near-death experience. And like Melvin Morris, who did this fabulous research in the 70s on near-death experiences of children, the children would say, depending on their cultural references, if they were raised with Jesus, they would see Jesus. If they were raised with nothing at all, they would be greeted on the other side by Disney characters. You know, the Little Mermaid would be there. Or one kid said, I flew into the sun and it hugged me. So that's the light. But, you know, when it's coming out of the mouth of a four-year-old, it's just amazing. So these experiences are subjective, and they are culturally influenced. Okay, so a Tibetan peasant is not probably going to see Jesus when they have a near-death experience. And that really, really shifted it for me in a lot of ways. And I started to think, where do we get this stuff from? And I realized, like, the Zulu guy. So some Zulu guy died and was resuscitated. And while he was out, he went somewhere where he saw his family members and his ancestors and the people from the tribe, and some of them were human and some of them might have been animals. And then he saw this lion and knew that it was the chief. So he comes back and he tells his village, oh, everybody was there. Some of them were animals, but the chief was a lion. And that goes into their legacy. And that's how we got all our stuff, like all this, you know, pearly gates and streets of gold and all of that. Probably somewhere in the Christian ancient world, somebody, not even the Christian ancient world, anywhere, somebody had that experience and saw pearly gates and came back and told their tribe this, and it got folded into the theology. So thankfully we have this stuff, and we have so much research on near death experience now. And I was talking to Raymond Moody about this, and we have this conversation a lot. Like, now that we know all this stuff, what are we supposed to do with it?
Exactly.
This is the talk I'm giving at IAMS in Berkeley next month. It's called Now That We Know, What Do We Do? So, and Raymond and I sit there and say, aren't you so sick of hearing these stories about the near-death experience? We've got 10,000 stories. Now what? And my answer to that is we learn about the cultural references, we learn techniques for journeying on our own to going to these places without having to die, through meditation, through shamanic journey, through whatever we can find, and we take this information and share it with the world to help relieve the fear of death, which is, by the way, at the root of all neurosis in human life.
Is it fear of death?
Fear of death. Fear of death is at the root of all neurosis. Mm-hmm. I am going to disappear, mm-hmm. and therefore I must cling and control everything. Let's see. Anything else? Comments? Anybody?
Yeah. In the movement from the beginning to the end of a sentence,
mm-hmm.
the life of each word arrives, comes into form, and then leaves. That hook for me, that holds the mystery.
Are you a writer? Mm-hmm. Right. So there's something like a cultural reference, right?
Okay, I'm always looking at, you know, the relation, you know.
And so a painter might see that in a painting context. So this is what we have to go out in the world and teach. You know, but as you said, what's your name?
Kaylee.
Yeah, Kaylee, I know you. Right. Glad you came. Even though we can't tell our relatives to think differently about death and God and all of that, how do we teach this? You know, and really the only way we can teach it is to live it. The hardest thing you learn as a chaplain is how to not talk and how to listen instead of talk. So this is one of my favorite stories. I had a patient in the hospital, a man who had just been diagnosed with some life-threatening illness, and he said to me, well, I've been a sinner all my life, and I guess I'm going to go to hell, but that's where the Muslims go, right? That's what he said to me.
Seriously?
He said that. That was my response, too. And then all my training was like, okay, don't hit him, you know, don't call him names, don't scream, you know, what do I say? And he asked me, that's where they go, right? Like, I'm supposed to validate this because I'm an educated theologian. And my instinct was to say, absolutely not. Everybody goes to the same place. Everything is equal. Nobody is bad or good. There's no heaven. There's no hell. There's no evil. There's no, but of course I can't do that. So my answer to him was, the perfect chaplain deflection. It doesn't matter what I think. What matters is what you think. That's what they teach us to do. And what he was really afraid of was dying. And, you know, he wouldn't know how to articulate this, but he was probably at some level afraid of bringing all his assumptions and his prejudices and all his hate and all his yucky stuff with him. But the weird thing about Christianity is, if your theology says that God loves everybody and forgives everybody, then why would this even be an issue? Then I guess all the Muslims are going to be forgiven, right? I mean, that's the thing, that's what gets really weird, and that's a whole other topic. But, you know, for a guy like that, and I'll give you another example. I had another guy who was a biker, had a really hard life, drugs and alcohol, and he was dying. And he was really concerned. He had become a Christian recently, and he was asking me, do I get to go to heaven, you know, because I'm accepted Jesus, but I'm like such a bad guy and I did so many bad things, I killed people, you know. And so what you want to do, and this is an answer to your question, Kaylee, if someone around you is struggling with something like this, is to turn it back on them. And so what I did with this guy is, well, okay, so what does your theology say about going to heaven and forgiveness? And he said, well, it says that if, as long as you accept Jesus, you're good to go. So I had him, I made him say that to me. And I said, well, you just answered your own question. If that's what you really believe, then you have nothing to worry about. But some part of him knew that that wasn't really what he really believed.
It wasn't working.
And he was having questions. And at the end of life, people do have these questions. But in order to help the people in your life, when you're faced with something like that, turn it back on them and ask them to tell you about their belief and their faith. And in the telling, they will start to question.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to be able to listen.
Yeah, when you say at the core, it's the fear of death is operating, that resonates. I'm kind of fond of also the idea that the fear of isolation is really motivating for a lot of people.
Mm-hmm.
If you connect those two, fear of being alone.
And depending on how you think about death, I mean, think about a lot of the stuff in our culture, like the old folk songs, the icy hand of death, the cold and lonesome grave, 6 feet under. You know, it's really scary and extremely isolating. And then you're going to miss your friends and your family. You're going to miss Earth. So if you're a Buddhist, you look at it like, I'm not going to miss anything because these things are going to go with me, and I'm going to come back, and I'm going to be with you again, and you again, and we're all going to be cycling through together, and I'm so glad to be releasing my attachments, because I'm going to go to another thing. That's how a Buddhist would think about it. But an atheist, or a person who thinks there's nothing after death, would think, I'm going to be alone under the earth, but I'll be dead, and I won't know it. You know, an atheist patient that I once had said that the thing that made him so sad about dying is that he always wanted to be in a sailboat race. And now he wasn't going to be able to do that. And I can't say, oh, sure, you can do it in your next life. So that's what I thought. There's a lot of transformation that needs to happen out there for people to be at peace with loss. And that, you know, goes back to the Richard Rohr quote of pain that is not transformed is transmitted. It could be transmitted into your next life.
What was his name again?
Richard Rohr, R-O-H-R.
R-O-H-R.
Do you have any of his books here?
I've seen him before.
Yeah, he's wonderful. He's a Catholic priest, former priest, I think. And he's a mystic, and he's just absolutely
there's a loss of the human species.
Yes, I'm glad you said
that.
I'm not attached to the human species at all, and it's absolutely fine with me. And
can
I feel
you repeat the question?
He was asking about the potential loss of the human species. Okay, so some of you guys might not like what I'm going to say right here, but I think that we need to live in a healthy world and have unpolluted water to drink and all of that. But in the bigger picture, the view from space, planets come and go all the time and we're nothing. And George Carlin says we're a surface infection on the earth. And so when I see extreme environmentalists saying, we got to save the planet, my Buddhist mind kicks in and says, no, we don't. It's just a planet. It's just a species. Why are we so arrogant to think that just because we're here, we have to contain and control everything? That's that assumption thing again, you know, that we assume that we live in this safe world. Now, I don't want to live in a polluted, terrible world. I don't want my descendants to either. And I will do what I can to keep the world clean and healthy and safe. But I'm not attached to this idea that the human species has to survive. No species survives forever. Who do we think we are? So there. So I said it. Yeah.
Earlier you mentioned that you
feel your son, he comes to you in other, like, in somatic experiences. I'm sure everyone has different personal experiences, but for you, how do you feel the presence of your son?
In the beginning, I used to feel him physically in the body. Behind me, like, and literally, I could feel him, like, breathing on my neck like we were spooning. and you can read about it, and it was very, very close. I could really feel, I'd get this, like, tickle on my back. And he even taught me a meditation that way. And he said, here's a meditation that you can do. Breathing with another person. This is actually a whole guided meditation that's really beautiful, where you imagine your loved one who's on the other side. And I actually have a don't let me forget to hand these out to you. You can imagine the person you love on the other side, and imagine that you're standing with them chest to chest, pressed up against, and that you're sharing a breath that's just going through your lungs, through theirs, back and forth and all around, just circulating through you and going through your lungs that are touching. And that creates a connection for the communication to happen. So he told me that one when I was feeling him breathing on my back. It wasn't much physical sensation with him, as it was just thoughts would just start coming into my head that I never thought before and did not sound like me talking. And I would just feel like, I gotta write this down, it's him. But I do, like, sometimes I'm just walking down the road and all of a sudden, everything's like shimmery, and I feel him. And I'll say, oh, there you are. What are you doing here? And sure enough, there'll be something that he wants me to know. And this happens a lot when I'm walking. And I'll be walking, and I have this feeling, and I just want to hold it and hold him there, because I can really feel him there. And I'm concentrating so much on holding that feeling there that, of course, it goes away. Mm-hmm. But it something remains, because then 2 minutes later, and I always talk to myself when I'm walking. I'm talking constantly. I never stop. I'll just start talking, and all of a sudden out of my mouth will come some wonderful thing that ends up going in a book or an article or a class or something, so I know that he came and gave it to me.
And you may have talked about this. Thank you. And you may have talked about this a little bit before I came in, but what about dreams, your take on dream realm and,
I'm so glad you asked me that.
People in the dream world.
I love the dream world so much. I would sleep 24 hours a day if I could, because I love the dream world. I do my best work here. And I started keeping a dream journal in 1997, typed on my computer. And it's 100 pages long, single-spaced, of all my most significant dreams. It's so amazing. But after my son died, he not only comes to me in dreams all the time, that's where I do my most communication with him. And I'm glad you asked, because I forgot about that. I'll give you a great example. So I was designing this grief workshop, and I wanted to think of a way to open sacred space other than the four directions, which I was kind of getting tired of. I wanted something new. And I've just been thinking about it. How can I create sacred space? So I have a dream that my son and I are on a stage in front of an audience, and he's sitting here in his wheelchair, and he couldn't talk at the end of his life. And he's trying to tell me something. He's tugging on my shirt. And I'm going crazy because I can't understand. I'm like, what, baby? What do you want? And he's like, he's trying to tell me something he wants me to say to this audience. All of a sudden, in the dream, these big block letters show up. R-U-A-H. Does anybody know what that is? Ruach?
Oh, spirit.
Mm-hmm. And then I wake up. And I remember, it's the Aramaic word for breath and also for spirit. And I remember, and I'm like, oh my God, I wake up, I run to Google, what is R-U-A-H? I'd never heard this before, and there it was. And I knew that's what he was trying to tell me, to use that for opening sacred space. So now I'm like, okay, it's 4 o'clock in the morning, I'm wide awake, how am I supposed to use this? And it just came to me, a chant in three-part harmony. I don't know why. I'm not a musician. I don't think about things like that. But I just knew, so that what I, the next time I did this and I taught the workshop, I took the room, we can even do this if you want, and I put them into three groups, and this section went ruah, and this one ruah, ruah, and when there's 200 people doing that, it's amazing. So that was how I got my answer about how to open sacred space. I'll tell you another one if you want. You want to hear another one like that? So, he also comes to other people. I have a lot of friends who are mediums because of the Afterlife Conference. My friend Austin Wells will sometimes call me and say, your son is talking to me. He wants me to give you a word. The word is station. Does that mean anything to you? I'm like, no. Train station? Television station? What is he talking about? But I know Austin. She's such a good medium, and I know this is real. This was at the same period of time that I got the Ruah thing, when I was planning this new grief workshop that I was putting together. It all of a sudden hit me, Stations of the Cross. Mm-hmm. And then I thought, why would he want me to know about Stations of the Cross? And I just think through it. I call out, and I'm like, what? What do you want me to do with this? And then I just let it go, and I calm down, and it emerges, it comes. And what it turned out to be is those three altars I told you about in the grief workshop. They're called Stations of the Heart. And they're based on the analogy of Stations of the Cross, which means Jesus' walk from his death to his resurrection, that is reenacted in the Catholic Church. And so the meaning of that with these altars is, this is our walk, these Stations of the Heart, from this death inside ourselves that we experience with this loss to our resurrection when we're carrying this bowl of stuff outside. So that's how the messages come. And all of you get messages like that too in your dreams. It might not be from your dead loved ones, but it's from your angels and your guides and all of that. And here's a little handout that will help you with that.
Do you believe that it is a spirit speaking to you, communicating you in dream world, that is, they're there with you?
So many people are there with you. There are two pages.
It's not just imagination. It's not
oh God,
conscious
no.
imagining. And that, like,
well, what is imagination?
Imagination. Well, that's a good question.
I mean, when you make art, you make a painting. It comes from your imagination.
It's energy moving into some form. So, like, imagination.
Well, if you believe that we're connected to the spiritual world through a conduit, then everything that comes to us comes from there. Because we're not here alone. We're not cut off. You know, I always interpret the concept of the Holy Spirit as the conduit between the earth plane and the other planes. Because ask a million Christians what the Holy Spirit is, and you'll get a million different answers. Nobody knows. So you have to make it up for yourself. Pretty much. Did I have enough of those?
I have a question. So my friend's mom, one of my friends recently passed in the ghost ship fire, and her mom's really angry at God.
Mm.
So she's just like wondering why God, like why wasn't it me? I just listened to her. I don't really have any responses. I think this is just her process of anger as part of the grief process. So I don't have a question. I forgot it.
Well, you missed the part where I talked about that.
Okay.
But there's if you look at my second book, Embracing Death, we look at grief, gratitude, and God. It talks a lot about that. People, I was talking earlier about how we have certain assumptions about how the world works. And people who have that theology believe that there's a God in the sky that protects us like a mother hen. And that if we do certain things and we're good...
I think she's seen something to blame.
Well, she does. But you will find, if you scratch the surface of that blame, that there's a theology at the core of that. I've learned from working with so many grieving people that you can't separate psychology from theology, and you can't separate the grief process from some embedded theology that somebody holds. And if someone says, I'm mad at God, why did he let this happen? There's a theology speaking there. that, and, okay, do you want to hear one more thing?
Well, what
it's going
you,
like way over our time.
In response to,
you can't do anything in response to that. She's going to have to go
through all of her processes.
She's going to have to work it out. You could give her some books to read.
I just hang out with her and make flower collages at Goshen.
That is the best
really
thing that you can do, is just be present with people. That's what chaplains do. And just listen to her. And, don't try to teach her
anything. I'm not trying to teach her anything.
Yeah.
I'm trying to figure
because she's in the process
too,
of learning it right now.
Like, hear her. But then when she's like, there's rainbows, Sarah's here. I'm like, yes, there's
Sarah's
here. Yeah.
Well, she is.
Yeah.
I mean, you guys have all heard the stories of, like, the person's favorite bird was a robin. And after they died, a robin landed on the porch every day. I mean, you know, yeah. I think that's real.
Yeah.
Why not? Okay. Is our time up?
Yep.
Oh, it is. Look at 5 minutes. Okay. Well, thank you.
Thank you.
Oh, I just want to let you guys know the Afterlife Conference is coming to Portland in June. If you have any chance in the world that you come to Portland, come to our conference, here are flyers, and here's a $25 off discount. Okay.
Such a deal.
I just had to say that. And this is my email list. If you would like to stay in touch with me and get our newsletter and all this stuff, sign it there. Okay.
Thank you so
thank
much.
You.
It's my duty, of course, to point out, number one, that we have a donation bowl over there on the counter, and we encourage you to contribute to it because we share half with our speakers to further their work and retain half to maintain the space for further such events. And, of course, to also to point out that Terry's books are right here on the counter for you to look at as, excuse me, if you pick up some discount coupons, etc., over here, you can check out the books over here. And thank you all for coming tonight.
Thank you.